Welcome, bridge builders, border smashers, connectors, lovers, and writers. I'm Grant Faulkner, executive director of a big community of writers that builds bridges between people through stories and creativity. And I'm here with my co-host and fellow bridge builder, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, I'm focused on building bridges over borders, through borders, around borders, and underneath borders, because our guest today, Luis Alberto Urrea, says that that is his purpose as an author. And I think it's really the purpose of every writer. We try to connect with others, and that's the beauty of the endeavor. That's what makes the struggle worth it.
Yeah, so true, Grant. I mean, our stories are perhaps the best kind of bridge because they do transcend obstacles and they're fundamental, you know, in terms of how we connect with others. And Luis has such an amazing life story in terms of borders, both physical and metaphorical. We were just talking before the show about this amazing talk you can watch on YouTube if anybody wants to, about his story of being born in Tijuana on the border of the U.S. and Mexico to a Mexican father and an American mother. And so he was born straddling a border. And he said in an interview with Terry Gross, the kitchen was the United States. The living room was Mexico. One side was struggling with all her might to make me an American boy. And the other, with all of his might, was trying to keep me a Mexican boy. And I'm sure that a lot of people can resonate with that particular kind of metaphor. And it's interesting because he doesn't define a border as a barrier, but as a bridge. And he sees his writing that way too, which he's going to talk about in our interview today. And I think that just makes it borders a place of connection and travel. And it also makes his writing a political act.
Yeah, I agree. The word political, of course, is a loaded one and a word I've shied away from at times, I think, when I think of my writing and writing in general. But the purpose of writing stories that break through barriers, travel over boundaries, and connect people inevitably has at least a grain of politics in it, if not more. Luis likes to quote advice given to him by the writer Rodolfo Anaya, who told him that if he could make his abuelita in Tijuana the grandmother of a reader in Iowa, he'd have committed the most powerful of political and moral acts. And I am that reader in Iowa, literally, because I grew up in Iowa. So I really appreciate this advice. And I like how he says that it's both political and moral, because I view this kind of connection as a spiritual matter as well as a political one. And Brooke, since we're living in an age where the discussion of borders is very pronounced and contentious, and since we're living in an age where I think our narratives of connection are more important than ever, I'm curious if you've experienced any recent stories that have served as bridges for you.
Yeah. You know, stories of other border crossings, actually, because this year has been the story of Latinx authors in a lot of ways. You know, we rang in the year in January with this scandal about American Dirt that we've talked about a couple of times, and we're going to ask Luis about that as well. But it led to me reading Marcelo Castillo Hernandez's Children of the Land, because after that book, he got a lot of attention, and then he was a guest on this show. And then I also read Reina Grande's memoir, The Distance Between Us, also because of American Dirt, because she was another vocal critic and she actually went on Oprah and spoke out about own voices. And now Reina is going to be teaching at my memoir boot camp in the fall. And I'm just really excited about this because I found it, you know, these were stories that I wasn't particularly keyed into. And yet I grew up myself like an hour and a half from the Mexican border. I walked into Tijuana countless times when I was young, you know, crossed that border. And I didn't realize that there were these people crossing over borders illegally. It just wasn't part of my awareness, although, of course, it should have been. You know, if you're in San Diego, or I've driven through San Diego, you know, there are signs on the freeway, literally, of images of a family crossing the freeway to warn people not to hit them. So it's very much part of your consciousness when you grow up in Southern California. And so, you know, it's interesting to me when it comes to the reading experience, how something can be so close to home and yet so far away. And this is the power of books. And it's also the power of awareness, right? Because I'm a person who's incredibly keyed into memoir, but I didn't read these memoirs until something happened that triggered me to read more about it. And so I'm very grateful for that, which, you know, really did come out of American Dirt originally.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you talk about that, Brooke, because I'm thinking that they're borders in our own communities as well. And I've been thinking about this because I've been watching Last Chance U on Netflix with my kids. And the most recent season focuses on Laney College, which is in Oakland, not too far from my house, but really miles and miles away in many ways. And the show, if you don't know it, is a type of Friday Night Lights, but focused on junior college football. And getting up close to the student athletes' lives has been eye-opening. For so many of them, it is their last chance, or it feels that way. And it's been interesting for my kids to see kids who are basically the same age of them, but these student athletes, you know, for instance, one of them has to sleep in his car at night because he can't afford an apartment in the very expensive Bay Area. Or one of them has children and he's going to college and playing football and trying to make it to a Division I school, you know, so he's a struggling parent, athlete, and student. And anyway, my kids are realizing their privilege with every episode. It's really interesting to hear their reaction. And I'm certainly realizing my own privilege as well. But I also feel very grateful that this story is available as a bridge builder within, you know, our own community, and makes me much more aware of what's going on. And another bridge I want to talk about is the bridge to our own stories. And I love this story behind Louise's latest novel, The House of Broken Angels. The novel's about his own brother's death and his family's struggles, and it's really rich with layers of different stories. But he didn't see it or recognize it as a story that readers would find interesting or rewarding. It was only when he had the chance to hang out with the author and poet Jim Harrison, who was a lifelong hero of his, that the gift of this story became apparent to him. And the story is that they were at a supper, and Harrison startled Louise and just kind of asked bluntly, "Tell me about your brother's death." And then he sat beside Louise as almost like mesmerized in meditation as Louise was telling him the story. And after he was done, Jim Harrison said, "Sometimes God hands you a novel. You better write it." And that was the moment he started writing it. So here's what's interesting about this to me, Brooke, is one, the way we can overlook the value of our own stories, the way we can, you know, miss a story, perhaps because we don't think anyone would read it and that it's not important. And then secondly, sometimes it takes a random encounter like the one Louise had with Jim Harrison to see the story, but you still have to be attuned to the possibilities, to the gift of it, to build a bridge to your story.
I love that so much, Grant. You know, it reminds me of conversations I have with authors I work with who have similar kinds of epiphanies about the values of their stories. And sometimes I think it kind of slaps you upside the head. Sometimes I think authors sit with something for a really long time, and oftentimes much too long, right? I mean, I know people who have sat with like, I want to do this, I think I should, for a decade, and then finally feel the push or decide that it's time to take the plunge. And right now, I think we're in such an important moment when it comes to the value of our stories, or people thinking about the value of their stories and the stories they want to tell or have to tell. People speaking out and speaking up about our own legacies, just because of the agitation that is in our culture right now and the things that we're going through. It's a time of great tumultuousness, right? And so all of that in what I'm seeing in writers is that there's just a lot at stake, and people are processing and reeling. And that's actually a good environment for writing to come out. You know, some people can feel stymied by it, but a lot of people are really inspired by their agitation, and they're looking for outlets and making time for their writing as well. So I'm inspired by that. And Grant, you know, it sounds like that story really struck a chord with you, the Jim Harrison, Luis story, this notion of God handing you a story. And so I'm wondering if you have felt that way, or maybe you felt like you overlooked the value of your own story in some way.
I think it's a good question for authors to constantly ask themselves, really. And so I'm definitely asking that question to myself now. I have, just because I'm wrapping up a few projects, so I have this question of what's next. And I have several novel ideas that are, you know, been well explored in folders on my computer, like they're ready to go. And so usually when it comes time to write a new novel, I simply choose from one that's in the queue, the one that's calling me the most. But I've decided this time to just do a bigger pause and really meditate on this question, where if there are stories I'm overlooking, because a novel can take years to write, so it's a big commitment. And I'd like to think about whether I should take an entirely different direction. I've been thinking a lot of Rachel Cusk, who decided to, I guess when she was about my age, that she was bored with the way she was writing novels. So she kind of listened to herself and followed an entirely different path, which led to her recent trilogy, which I just think is brilliant. But looping back to Luis, I like how he talks about his creative process. He helps me think about this. It's a little mystical. He says that he's more like a gardener or a farmer, and that his productive periods are seasonal. He said that he follows the dictate of the haiku poet Esau, who said, simply trust. It always comes if you simply trust. And I think that's a key part of building any bridge, whether it's a bridge to your own story or the bridge you build to another through your story. At the heart of it all is trust. Trust that you'll identify your story and listen to it. Trust that your story matters. Trust that, like a farmer, you'll get through the fallow periods. The rain and the sun will come. And then trust in yourself to persevere. You know, when I hear authors struggle with this, I usually think of the words like belief in these matters. And I suppose belief includes the word trust, but it's so easy to stop trusting yourself, to doubt the bridge you're building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's this other quote that we have from Luis, and he says, writers like me stand outside the wall and throw love notes over the top, hoping somebody will find them. And that's such a great image for what you're talking about with trust, because what a beautiful way to think about trust and healing and building bridges. It does start with viewing your writing as a love note that you throw into the world blindly, and you hope that there's someone out there who will find your words someday. And so I think we can leave readers with that image of what their love note might be that they want to throw over the wall for someone to find.
I love that image, Brooke, as we head into our short break, and we'll get to hear from the Love Note Serenader himself, Luis Alberto Urrea. Welcome back, everyone. I'm excited to welcome our next guest, Luis Alberto Urrea, who has been called a literary badass and a master storyteller with a rock and roll heart. So get ready. Luis is a prolific writer of 17 critically acclaimed and best-selling books, and he's won numerous awards for his poetry, fiction, and essays. The Devil's Highway, his 2004 nonfiction account of a group of Mexican immigrants lost in the Arizona desert, won the Lannan Literary Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And most recently, he wrote The House of Broken Angels, which is, as Luis describes it, the story of an American family, one that happens to speak Spanish and admire the Virgin of Guadalupe. We'll talk more about that today. Welcome, Luis.
Hi, everybody.
Yeah, well, I'm interested. You were born in Tijuana, Mexico, to a Mexican father and an American mother. And so it seems like you were born between two nations and cultures geographically as well as within your family. And you've said that writers build bridges, not borders. And so I was wondering if you could talk about what building bridges means in your writing and why building bridges has been a primary motive in your writing, a calling, so to speak. And I want to welcome your pet dog to the podcast as well.
Do you hear the dogs? I warned you. I told you. Let's just make believe they're guard dogs at the border. It'll set an agenda. Well, you know, building bridges is, you know, I didn't know that that was the essence of what my life was going to be, you know, but, you know, I born, like I said, in Tijuana. Yesterday was my birthday, so I've been thinking about this a lot. And, you know, my mom was American, didn't speak any Spanish, had me by cesarean section in the clinic upstairs from a drugstore on the road to the dog track in Tijuana. I mean, that's pretty picaresque, you know. My dad was a Mexican military man who had ended up in Tijuana after a lot of bad mojo with the Mexican government. And we had this life, and I thought I was perfectly Mexican and started realizing that I was blonde and blue-eyed, and that was kind of weird. But, you know, I spoke Spanish before I spoke English, and it was a semi-impoverished dirt street in a neighborhood in Tijuana. And I ended up with tuberculosis as a little guy, and they came to San Diego, and we settled in a barrio Logan Heights, which I often in my talks called Diet Mexico, because everybody there was also, you know, Mexican. And that was my world, and I was going back and forth between Tijuana and San Diego, Tijuana, San Diego. It was all the same to me. I didn't see any difference. And then all of a sudden, we moved up to a white working class suburb, and I had no idea, first of all, that I had a Mexican accent, and it was brought shockingly to my attention by the people I was now living among. And I also found out that people in at least San Diego weren't all that fond of Mexicans. And you have to understand that the only non-Mexican person I was intimate with or knew in any way was my mom. Everybody else, everyone I loved, cherished, looked up to, feared, turned to for history, stories, anecdotes, all that stuff you would absorb as a kid were all Mexican. Spanish speakers, or they had the very strong Tijuana accent like I had. I had that when I got to Claremont, San Diego. And I lost that quickly. And I did not know that I, you know, to survive, had to suddenly switch over to mom channel instead of dad channel. But that set this weird course for my future life, you know, realizing that I was straddling two worlds that I thought was one world. And so that idea of bridges is just that, that you end up being a communicator. And the one small story that is probably perfect to tell you, because I don't usually tell this to people, is that, you know, we were also, as a family, a conduit for all of these Mexican folks, you know, who our mailbox got mail for 10 or 13 people until the mailman finally asked my parents, how many damn people are living in your house? And I didn't understand anything about documented or undocumented. So suddenly we were this handy address for all these people who, you know, were living under the radar. And one of my cousins from Tijuana, Margarita, Spanish speaker, but had fallen in love with a soldier who was fighting in Vietnam. And I, in fifth grade, became the translator for her of her letters back and forth to this GI. So, you know, talk about bridges and talk about finding your life as a writer. It just happened partially through that, right? And fortunately or unfortunately for me, a lot of those letters were quite filthy.
I love this. You've been doing this from such a young age, Luis. You know, I've heard you refer to advice you received from Rodolfo Anaya, who said to you, if you can make your abuelita in Tijuana the grandmother of some reader in Iowa, you've committed the most powerful of political and religious acts.
Yeah.
So how did that advice, or does it continue to influence your writing? And does it shift your sense of who you're writing for?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I you know, I think if you're going to be a real artist, you need to write, you know, for yourself and your conscience. But I've always been wed to this obsession with witness. So I want to represent. And that dictum of Rudy's is with me all the time. All the time. And, you know, I was very fortunate that my discoverer, my first writing guru, was Ursula Le Guin. So, you know, I've been blessed or cursed with these people who were kind of paragons of integrity and witness and verity in what they wrote. So I always feel like I have to kind of live up to their example. But yeah, part of the evolution, I think, as you write, is to realize who you represent. And although I'm a dyed in the wool, good old bleeding heart liberal, I realize that I want to speak to everybody, and I want people to feel respected and heard and represented well. And that's a question of, you know, just, I think, growing up and maturing. And I thought I had it down until it was time to write The Devil's Highway. And I realized that I had to represent the U.S. Border Patrol, among other people. And that was a crew that I had just gone in not liking in any way and thought, I'm going to do them in, man. And then I found out, to my great shock, that those guys were human beings too. Damn it.
That's interesting, Luis. You know, I've talked to a lot of writers who doubt that their story is original enough, or if it's marketable, or if anyone would really want to read it. And I guess we all grapple with this in some regard, but you've grappled with it very tangibly. I read that at the beginning of your career, a New York editor actually told you nobody cares about starving Mexicans.
Yes.
That's amazing. And that you were also told at one point that you should change your name to an Anglo name so it wouldn't sound so different.
Right. Yeah, that was toxic, man.
I bet. Well, I was just curious how did you dig down and you know, say, no, I'm going to keep my name. I'm going to keep writing stories about Mexicans and Mexican Americans.
Oh, gosh. You know, my dad's nickname for me was La Mula, which is the mule. And it drove him insane because I was so stubborn. And you've got to understand that those comments came during 10 years straight of rejection of this first book, which was Across the Wow. Wire, which came from, you know, I thought everybody would go for it. I thought, you know, I'm old enough that I remember The Children of Sanchez. You remember that book? And I thought, by God, I'm going to update The Children of Sanchez and show people what, you know, the underclass goes through. And I was also on a Steinbeck thing. I thought, this is my Grapes of Wrath, man. But it was, you know, a nonfiction account of my work with relief workers and missionaries in Tijuana in the garbage dumps. And I thought, boom, this is, you know. And I had miraculously been hired to teach expository writing at Harvard. I'd never been anywhere, and I still don't know how I got that job, divine intervention or something. But there I was in Massachusetts for the first time, seeing America really for the first time, and thinking about those people. And I wrote the book and it was rejected. I wrote the book and it was rejected. And during that process, these things began to happen. And that was the first quote, nobody cares about starving Mexicans. And yeah, I was told that the only, you know, Latino writers who are going to make it are people who have an Anglo name, like Sandy Cisneros. I was like, what? You know, Denise Chavez. They had, you know, Rudy Anaya. I thought, well, to hell with that. And I was at that time just writing as Luis Urrea. And so the mule kicked in, and I remember getting all Chicano, and I thought, I'm going to add my middle name. I'm going to become Luis Alberto Urrea. I'm going to become more Mexican. How do you like that? And I always tell audiences, they didn't like that. But I was kind of stuck with it, you know, and I'm glad because that battle, you never know of what value that will be later for people or even for yourself. So any young writers I work with, I can tell them that story and say, you know, you've got to persevere. You've got to go forward with your vision and take the lumps, whatever they may be. So when I do a workshop, I always tell the writers, rule number one in my writing workshop is wear the bastards down. You got to keep coming back.
There's the badass side of you. And I think so helpful too for up and coming writers. But then on the flip side of that is this actual part of writing being healing. And you've said it, you said literature is one of the healing arts, heal the world with it. And there's a lot of conversation in the writing world about the ways in which writing can be therapeutic because it can allow you to claim or reclaim your story. And I'm just curious how this holds true for you. You know, has writing been a source of healing? And does it heal in the personal sense, or is the healing about the ways in which you can reach to that bigger political level that occurs when you're building bridges to a reader who hasn't lived your same experience?
Yeah. You know, for me, it's a one person at a time thing. I don't think about movements or audiences or, you know, mega sales. Or anything like that. I'm never going to be Stephen King, you know. I'm never going to be Neil Gaiman, probably. But you know, there are people who read the stuff and they respond to it powerfully, and that moves me on a person to person level. But you know, I just have to reiterate, I come from that world I told you about, and then, you know, I was the first one in my family to go to college. That's how I met Ursula Le Guin. My father was killed in my senior year of college, and it was a ghastly experience. It was, he died badly at the hands of Mexican police in Mexico, and they actually sold me his corpse. I couldn't bury him. I had to buy the corpse. It just devastated us completely in every way. And that's how I ended up. I wanted to do something that mattered. The world didn't seem to have any meaning at that point. And that's how I went back to Tijuana to help the poor, something my own Mexican family was not fond of. they didn't want anything to do with, you know, dirty, poor people with lice and so forth. I did. I just felt drawn to it. So I think the healing part is maybe me healing my own history. But, you know, I remember what it's like to have a child with such bad lice that his whole head was just a sea of pus. And it was the only way to deal with it was to actually reach in louse by louse and pull it out. I remember that because to me, that partially is writing. Every one of us, every single one of us, even the Kardashians, are going to spend some time in the Tijuana garbage dump, whether it's, you know, disease, sorrow, collapse, survival of some terrible experience, even if your Beamer breaks down, whatever your definition of hitting those places where you lose all hope and all energy. Those are true human experiences for all of us. And, you know, I've been there a lot. So I feel that. And it's played out to me, you know, on tour. Not that any one of us gets to tour anymore, but you know, the experience with readers is astonishing to me. And, you know, people mostly they want hugs. And they often come and start confessing the most unbelievable things to me. And I think, you know, I used to want to be a priest. Maybe this was my way of being a priest, you know, writing this stuff. And just as a little, you know, as they used to say in Louisiana, lanyap to all this, a little footnote to all this is that whole healing art stuff, and you've probably seen this in the documents, but it came from working on The Hummingbird's Daughter for 25 years. And, you know, at least half of that time working with medicine women and shamans to understand the material in the book. And they're the ones who told me that. You should study and be one of us. And I'd say, I don't know how to do that. And I wish I could heal people. I really do. I think I'd be the... And they were very condescending and said, oh, well, if you're not willing to do the work, I guess you can do it with writing. Writing's a healing art. And they had these beautiful metaphors for what writing does for people. And that's cool. You know, it's an ancient... We're dealing with the very ancient, pre-biblical ancient thing, which is the story, which is the morning fire where we gather to tell our dreams to each other and understand our existence.
That's so interesting, Louise. And this is switching the topics of that tradition of storytelling, I guess. But I wanted to talk a little bit about American Dirt, because you were such a steady voice of reason during the controversy earlier this year.
Oh, my God.
And, it's, you know, it was a novel that apparently pulled a scene straight from one of your books. And Brooke and I listened to the interview you did on Latino USA, and it struck me that you seem genuinely pained by the whole experience, and yet there's this badass side of you as well, maybe exemplified by your story of being the mule and your persistence or insistence. I wonder if there's more to say here about how you both hold the pain of being a badass simultaneously in terms of your experience in American book publishing and what you're feeling about the novel or the conversation that ensued in the aftermath of its publication, you know, this many months later.
Well, you know, this whole badass thing is kind of hilarious to me, because that's not how I see myself. I'm, you know, a suburban dad with yappy dogs, and I teach creative writing. You know, it's hardly a heavy metal musician or a Hell's Angel dude. But yeah, that was a strange experience, and I refused to engage in the battle. I didn't. I thought it was just, you know. And in fact, I told Maria Hinojosa, "You're the only person I will talk to about this." And she, you know, she has this infernal way of getting into your soul. So when she wanted to talk about this scene that was controversial, I told her, "Yeah, it's on page 157 of By the Lake of Sleeping Children." You know. And it was an explosion of outrage from Mexican American critics or scholars in Mexico who were pointing out all the ridiculousness and awfulness in that book. And you know, people had experiences. You know, I've never told this to anybody, but you know, Oprah called me and wanted to know, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? And I thought, I'm getting yelled at by Oprah. This is cool. So, no, I don't know that there was any kind of a sense of a badass. I never feel that way. But I do think that there are moments, you know, that call for you to at least try to set the record straight, even a little bit, you know. And all I said to Oprah about all this, at one point she said, "What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do?" Just like that. And I thought, this is my lifelong Oprah memory, the only time I'll ever talk to her. And I said, "You've got to be Oprah. You've got to do what Oprah does." And she said, "Turn this into a learning experience." I said, "Yes, ma'am," which I thought was great, you know, and off she went. But I said, "I won't have anything to do with it." Because it was, you know, we have better things to do than worry about, you know, someone's massive success. And she, Janine, did very well. And she's got another big book contract. And, you know, no, she wasn't hurt. But I think she was sort of spiritually probably hurt by all the fury that it unleashed. But, you know, it was time. It was time for fury. And, you know, publishing companies in New York are trying. They listened to the uproar, and they're trying really hard now to open their gates a little more to people of color and so forth, which I think is all positive. And had the COVID crisis not struck, I think you would have seen the burgeoning kind of civil rights movement that was being born in a literary fashion would have carried on with a lot of fire, but other things overwhelmed it, as this magnificent Trump era has shown. There's always some new tide of sewage to come over us. But yeah, that's all I have to say really about it. I thought it was unbelievable and, you know, nonsensical. And there are some brilliant critical pieces you can read about what is so off about this book. You know, people were like, wait, a middle class, upper middle class, possibly rich woman in Acapulco gets on top of the bestia. Can't she just buy a plane ticket? She could fly to Tijuana, no problem. You know, things like that. It's just everything was a little bit off. And, you know, a lot of people love it, and more power to them. I'm not one of them, but, you know.
Well, Luis, a lot of what you're just talking about transitions nicely into this last question that I have for you. You know, you've come a long way since the beginning of your career. You're an award-winning bestselling author and an inspiration to many, and I think especially Latinx authors. You know, and we're talking about this moment of racial reckoning, which I totally agree with you. It started before COVID, and all the stuff with American Dirt was in January. And, you know, I also think in some ways COVID exacerbated it, right? And hopefully for good end results. I'm wondering if you feel that young Latinx authors who are up and coming will have a different experience of publishing than you did, and whether you have greater hope for writers of color in general.
Oh, I do. Don't you? I absolutely
do. Yeah.
And you know, the thing is that the part of what we have to deal with is the cliche about who we are. You know, bad hombres, whatever that crap is, you know. This business about the wall, the big, beautiful wall. And you know, just if you have any wisdom at all, and you look at, for example, the secret police that have appeared, which are largely Border Patrol, BORTEC agents, you know, pepper spraying and rubber bullet shooting, protesting moms in Portland or in D.C., that should tell you something. And what the message is those guys don't have a whole lot to do. Apparently the swarms of imaginary Mexicans storming the wall, these guys can go to Portland and kick around Americans because there's nothing for them to do at this wall. It's being besieged perhaps by rabbits. It's, you know, it's, you can go down there today and go look for body parts. You can find skeletons. I mean, the people are dying to try to get here to just provide us with strawberries and tomatoes. Come on, man. So when you look at the reality of who we are, just look. People are university trained now. I, from Rampa Independencia in Tijuana, went and taught expository writing at Harvard. Hello. You know, it was kind of strange. This is a new world, and the writers are very talented. And, you know, I'd like to think that part of the response to the Trump era is a lot more advocacy among those of us who have been fortunate enough to get our toe, you know, in the door. Someone told me once, I think it was Rudolfo Anaya, in fact, that our job, certainly as Chicanos, as Mexican-Americans, or Latinx now, I guess, is that, you know, we're called on to step up, step up, step up on every step. But if we don't reach back and take a hand and help somebody up a step, we're violating the blessing we got. And he also told me, you know, the thing about that step is if you don't use it to get to the next step, sooner or later it'll turn upside down and you'll find out it's a coffin and you'll be trapped in it forever. And so, you know, that relentless drive is partially political, but for me, it's artistic. You always want to do greater work. You know, you're challenging your own self in the limited time you have on Earth. And that it speaks to people on both sides of my ethnicity means everything to me. That you as one artist can be a dialogue between people who may never get to dialogue. That's magic. So, you know, I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Well, it's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us on Right Minded, too.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much, Luisa. It's a treat.
Thank you.
We will be right back with today's book talk.
Okay, we're back with Book Talk, which is me and Grant's book picks. And this week I chose the novel Loose. Loose is a She Writes Press novel. It is incredibly heart-rending, and it's also the story of a border crossing. In this story, it's Alma Cruz, and she has this quest to go to El Norte. And what I loved about this novel is just the rendering of a young girl who crosses the border sort of unwittingly. It's a complicated story, as many of them are and must be, and the harrowing journey that she has along the way. And I talked about these other memoirs that I read, and I loved those memoirs, but there is something different about a novel, you know, that something just a little more ethereal in a way, and a way in which an author steps into a novel story, and perhaps that has a little bit more creative leeway, you know, not that the experiences of the memoirists weren't plenty harrowing enough, but there is a certain tidiness, you know, that happens with a novel. And I couldn't recommend this enough. I just think that Loose, a novel by the author Deborah Thomas, is a gorgeous book. And so I highly recommend it. How about you, Grant?
Yeah. Every year I like to return, or at least kind of page through and read my underlined quotes from the book, The Gift, which is by Lewis Hyde. And I'm, you know, opened this up particularly when I read some of those quotes that we just mentioned from Luis earlier, because I think Luis writes with this sense of giving a gift to others. And I just want to read one quote from The Gift. He says, "There is an instructive series of gifts in the Homeric hymn to Hermes. Hermes invents the first musical instrument, the lyre, and gives it to his brother Apollo, whereupon he is immediately inspired to invent a second musical instrument, the pipes. The implication is that giving the first creation away makes the second one possible. Bestowal creates that empty place into which new energy may flow." And that's the way I think about Luis's writing and his concept of writing to create bridges. You create one bridge, and then other bridges are spawned from that.
That's great, Grant. Thank you so much. And thanks, everybody. We hope you're enjoying the book talk. We do encourage you to send us your own recommendations because it helps us to think about what are the new books that our listeners are reading. And it's fun to talk about what we're reading in addition to what we're inspired by, just in terms of the writerly content that we're giving you each week. And yes, we are a weekly podcast. You know it, Right Minded. And the best thing that you can do for us is subscribe, you know, download us so that we show up in your feed every Monday. And we wouldn't mind a rating. We ask for them a lot, we know, but it does help us. So just get in there and press those stars, and then you'll know that you'll see us again next week.